conference today? Are you going to have television or radio advertising, or is this going to be an online campaign? What's the plan here?
And you didn't address that to anyone in particular, but this is Jim Greenwood.
Well, I'm not sure who should answer that question.
Yeah, understood. So it's a multifaceted campaign. It's a campaign in which we are in for the long run. We will be doing advertising in the four states. I assume that the materials you may have received indicate the four states in which we are going to initiate our advertising campaigns, but these are states that demonstrate the breadth and the depth of the advanced fuel and renewable fuel industry. We are our ultimate goal is to make sure that every member of Congress, every critical person in this administration and whichever administration takes over next year, as well as governors and other policymakers at the state level, understand the points that we've made today, and that is that this is a critical renewable fuel standard is critical to our America's leadership, brings the benefits that it has brought us, and we've reiterated those in the call this morning, and that any thought of undoing it would do long and lasting and essentially unnecessary harm to what is the bright future that we envision continuing to create through renewable fuels.
Thank you. That was Jim Greenwood speaking, right?
Yes, it was.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we'll go to Amanda Paterka at Greenwire.
Hi there. Campaign ads promoting coal, oil, and gas and or criticizing clean energy have topped some $150 million this election cycle, according to a recent New York Times analysis. Just wondering, I mean, you've been competing against these types of resources for several years. How is your strategy this time around different for, you know, competing against resources like that? And are you worried at all that your message will still be lost? I guess this is for Jim Greenwood or anyone else
right.
who
well,
would be more
I'll
appropriate
take it, and
for
if anyone else has responses, they're welcome to chime in, certainly. We don't anticipate having the kind of resources that you're talking about. Frankly, our fight is arguably less uphill than some of the older fossil fuel industry is faced with. We are correctly perceived as the way toward a future that has less reliability on foreign sources. We are perceived as the clean, innovative, sustainable kind of energy future that this country needs. And so I don't think we require, nor do we see ourselves in competition with those other industries. Obviously, our country is going to have a balanced approach to energy for the foreseeable future, but we certainly think we're and know that we are an important part of that, and we're going to be very much focused on direct contact with the 535 members of Congress and the 50 governors and, as I said, leaders in the executive branch of the federal government as well.
This is Admiral. Again, I'd like to just reinforce what Congressman Greenwood just said. We are an essential part and a growing part of anybody's all-of-the-above strategy. We need energy diversity, both for transportation fuel and for electricity production. And we have a tremendous amount of innovation. You heard it from Adam and Jim, two company heads that are really making great investments in producing an ever-widening array of products that directly contribute to America's security, America's economy, and America's environmental quality. So I just think that Congressman Greenwood has it exactly right. We are an essential part, a growing part, one that has the characteristics of innovation and really looks to the future. So I don't think about it so much as a competition as I do this is really an opportunity that our industry has seized, and the whole value chain is increasing, and it's producing more and more security and economic vitality throughout the country.
Thanks. I'm sorry. Who is this?
That was Admiral McGinn, Andy McGinn.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Rachel Gantz at Oil Price Information Service.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to find out how much the ad campaign will cost and what the length is.
Well, this is Jim Greenwood, and I've run campaigns over the last 30 years, and one of the things that I learned over those 30 years is that we don't signal our tactics, so we're not assigning a dollar figure to our campaign at this point.
Okay, and what is the length of the campaign?
As long as it takes. This is not a, a short run. We know that we're confronted with the immediate... we're confronted with an immediate threat that has been, as I mentioned in the beginning, heightened by the drought. We know that there will always be those who don't see the value of this program, or they have an agenda that they argue is counter to it. And so we think we need to stay geared up for the foreseeable future.
And we'll go next to Amy Harder at National Journal.
Hi, thanks for holding this call. I know there was a working group in the Senate with Senator Inhofe and Senator Coons to reexamine the RFS. I've spoken with Coons, and he supports the RFS but does see some potential chances.
This is Jim Greenwood. I have to step off and go to another phone for a moment. I'll be right back.
And I was going to want to ask Mr. Greener with this question, but if anybody else had a comment about this, he expresses interest, Senator Coons expresses interest in reexamining it, but not repealing it or substantially changing it in any way. Is there any wiggle room to revisit the RFS at all, given that the corn-based ethanol blend wall is fast approaching? That question would have been for Mr. Greenwood if he was here.
Well, this is Adam Monroe. I can take that from a business perspective. While there's lots of good intentions about various aspects of this bill and tweaking it and these kind of things, the possibility of opening it up and the process and how long that might take and all kinds of other factors are all the kinds of things that business people just hate hearing, because you just don't know where it's going to go. And I think one of the things that needs to be understood is we don't need to necessarily pursue the perfect and throw out the good, because look at what it's achieved so far today. And really, we don't want to sit here and pause waiting for some twist and turn around opening this up and seeing where it goes. All of that is just going to stop progress, and it's really not necessary. The factors that have caused people to look into this are some of the things that we want to help people to understand in a much better way. What the impact has been, what kind of technology has been developed, what kind of commercialization is going on now. And we don't really want to stop any of that. So just the process of reopening a pretty rock-solid policy as far as we see it is something that really makes us hesitate. And that's why a basic position is, let's just keep what we have. It's working, and it'll continue to work, and we'll keep producing the kinds of results that we are.
Hey, Adam, this is Jim Emberzia. Let me add to that. We're right now putting together the project financing for our first commercial plant. And investors, the first question we get asked is the government going to waffle on this thing? There's a lack of trust in any government policy, and I think one of the great things about the RFS is it's actually a long-term policy that fits with the investment community's horizon rather than a one- or two-year evergreen that you never know. So this is really one of the most significant policies I've seen that allow investors to make long-term decisions, because when you're building concrete and steel, that's not an overnight thing. And so, as Adam said, it's not what's done, it's just even if you do anything, now you've created suspicion in investors' minds. Well, if they're going to tweak this, then they might tweak that, and maybe we'll just back out of this deal. So it's absolutely critical to stay fast on this thing, to not get investors spooked, because it's hard to get people to commit long-term money today anyway, and this is a program that's helping make that happen.
I think that the Renewable Fuel Standard has all of the right characteristics that Adam and Jim have just highlighted. It creates market certainty. This is Adam McGinn. The RFS has created market certainty, and it has allowed the kind of investment to go into this growing industry and bring together all kinds of scientific and engineering disciplines to produce really, really good products. And it would be a real mistake to go back and revisit the RFS, because it is already working. We don't want to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory right at the time when we are on the cusp of really, really seeing a tremendous explosion in the kinds of beneficial products and jobs and investment that is happening because of the RFS and its long-term view.
We'll go next to Stephen Burke at Biofuel Center.
Hello, this is Stephen Burke, president of the Biofuel Center of North Carolina. The five of you have well laid out the imperatives to seek. The oppositional reasons are far less numerous and far smaller in number, and seem to come down to four main points. First is a generalized ideological and political. Second springs from vested interests in the old established order. Third is a general failure of smart thinking. And the fourth is a kind of muffy grouping of environmental energy inputs, not always well defined. My question about the Fuels America campaign, do you expect that one of those oppositional points of view will necessarily be most targeted to your success, or is it going to be more generalized? As Jim is not there, perhaps I can address it to Admiral McGinn.
Yeah, this is Admiral McGinn. I think that all of those points that you've made about potential sources of opposition are valid, but I think the more of a focus on what the RFS is doing, what is it has actually produced, that that Pam and Adam and Jim have outlined, it's really happening out there already. And so it's not a case of any one particular compelling threat to the RFS. The threat of the drought affects everybody throughout America in some way or another, but it is not sufficient cause to slow down the progress that is being made across the whole value chain in our agricultural communities, in our high technology industries, and the benefits that are being produced today for consumers in every aspect.
And this is Jim Greenwood. I've returned to the line. I apologize.
We'll go next to Chris Clayton at the Progressive Farmer.
Thank you for taking my question. I think perhaps this question may go to Mr. Greenwood or Admiral McGinn, but in 2008, there was a great deal of criticism over the food versus fuel campaign that was worked upon by the Glover Park Group, which you guys have now hired to run this campaign. What's the rationale for hiring the group that really threw ethanol under the bus in 2008 to pull you out from under the bus in 2012, so to speak?
Well, this is Jim Greenwood. I'm not sure I'll buy the last portion of your characterization. But, pardon me?
I said, you recall 2008, there was a great deal of criticism.
If you'll allow me, I said I won't characterize the last part of your characterization, insofar as being pulled out from under the bus. However, having said that, Glover Park is good. They know the issue. They've changed their focus, and we're glad to have them on our side.
We'll go next to Yulia Chernova at Dow Jones.
Hello, this is Yulia Chernova with Dow Jones. Now, just to follow up on that previous question, I guess that view of diverting corn and other sources to fuel rather than food when food prices are rising, it's still a concern for many people, and I'd just like to hear what are your views on that.
Well, I think there has been a lot of controversy. This is Jim Greenwood again. A lot of controversy with regard to the fuels versus food argument, and we think much of it has been bogus, to be blunt. If you look back to 2008 and look at the global supply issues, it was largely drought globally that had the impact that was felt then. And I should say, as particularly as the representative bio and at bio at our advanced fuels, we are moving inexorably towards a time when we'll be using a variety of fuels for energy. And as Adam Monroe has mentioned, that also includes products. Waste products from agriculture. It includes the ability to use trash. So we're moving in that direction.
And if I could, I'd like to ask two related questions. What is the current level of the RFS? And there was mention of the cost of $2 per gallon right now for. Biofuels. So, what is the need for subsidy as you see it right now, since prices
Adam to Monroe to respond to that.
Sure. So, I'm not sure I completely understood the very first part of your question as far as the level goes, but basically, we are on track to meet the volumes required in the renewable fuel standard. The advanced biofuels. Volumes have been adjusted, and there's a number of reasons for that, but that's the most advanced technology that's being developed, and so it's taken a little bit longer than we first thought, but now that technology and those fuels are ready, and they're being commercialized today. So to your question about $2 a gallon, what I was trying to get across was that in just a few short years, less than five, the cost to produce these advanced biofuels, and in this case cellulosic-based ethanol, started at $8. It's now possible to produce those fuels for $2 or less due to all the technology advancements. So that was the point on the $2, and forgive me for forgetting what the very last part of your question was.
Well, If it is, I mean, at what point do you feel like you will be competitive without the need to mandate volumes?
Yeah, that's right. You said subsidy. I remember that now. Just for the record, you know, we're not subsidized. So what the standard did was create a market, create a chance to play and compete on a level playing field. And in a 100-year-old industry, a strategic decision by the United States to get in there and create a little bit of space for innovators to compete is what the Renewable Fuel Standard did. And how long it will take? Well, we would like to see the volumes that were set out in the Renewable Fuel Standard met. And I don't know how long that takes. I just know that we're right at the doorstep now to make it happen. And it would be a mistake to pull that policy away right now. I think the time for that kind of discussion is in the future when we've seen the results and seen the progress.
This is Jim Greenwood. You know, our country has a long and rich history of forward-looking policymakers creating incentives for innovation that enables us to bring technologies to the fore before the private sector otherwise was willing to take those risks, and to enable the innovators to demonstrate the value and the efficiency of their products, and then historically over and over again, the private sector, the private investors have stepped in once the demonstration has occurred, and I think will be nothing unusual about that in our regard.
This is Admiral McGinn. I would add to that that it would be a tremendous mistake for anyone to try to defend the business as usual portfolio of our energy for transportation in particular. Congressman Greenwood pointed out in his opening remarks that we need to project ourselves ahead 20 years and looking back and asking the questions, are we more secure today than we would have been had we maintained the status quo? What has legislation that is forward-looking and stable and long-term, like the Renewable Fuel Standard, done for our economy, for our environment, for our energy security, and our overall national security? And I think the answer is clear. We're going to be in a lot better shape as a nation. We're going to be more secure, we're going to be more prosperous, and we're going to be healthier as a result of the great innovation that's going on and the kinds of products that are being produced by terrific companies.
Thank you very much.
We'll go next to Edward Felker at Energy Guardian.
Hi, this message is for Jim Greenwood. Thanks for holding the call. Jim, can you talk about why North Carolina and Arkansas are not included in the advertising campaign, at least as we're told so far, since those are the governors that have asked for the waiver, and whether those areas that have been hardest hit by the drought are areas that you really need to reach in this campaign? Thanks.
Well, that's an excellent question, but I'm afraid it's not one that I can answer. I wasn't directly involved in the selection of the states. I can tell you that perhaps others on the phone can help with that. I know that the states that we have chosen were chosen based upon, as I mentioned earlier, the variety and of applications of biofuels that occur in those states. Certainly not to say that we won't be taking our message to all of the states, and it certainly doesn't mean that we won't be talking with the governors and the congressional delegations from the states you've mentioned. It just means that for starters, we're focusing where we think we can draw attention to the success that we've already achieved in this industry. There is a tendency for some who haven't directly experienced our industry, particularly on the advanced side, to think that it is something that somehow is just posited into the future. And in fact, we have, as I mentioned earlier, $5 billion worth of committed investment already in cellulosic ethanol and more on the way. And it's important for us to demonstrate that this is not about a wing and a prayer. This is about decisions that have been made based on technology and economics of today. We want to demonstrate that and make sure that everyone in the country is aware of the success that we've already achieved.
Can I follow up to that, if I might? Both the president and Governor Romney have said that they support the RFS. Do you feel that they are being honest about that, that they are strong defenders, and that your challenge really is on Capitol Hill? Thanks.
Well, good question. We take them at their word, and certainly this administration and Secretary Vilsack have been very vocal, and Governor Romney has been equally steadfast in his support. Having served in the Congress for 12 years, I am familiar with scenarios in which must-pass legislation has amendments attached to it that may be opposed by the president, but become part of a larger package and become almost literally forced upon them. So we want to make sure that the support remains in Congress, and for those who are less familiar with us or even in opposition to us now, that they have the information they need, which we think once they do have, they'll be with us.
Thanks.
We'll go next to Brian Ulmer at Barn Media, Colorado Ag News Network.
have a couple of questions. Actually, the first one is for Adam Monroe. In your comments, you said that the United States has enormous crop waste, but in some parts of the country, field crop residues are required to stay in compliance with Farm Service Agency and Natural Resource Conservation requirements, and more importantly, cover to protect the land from wind erosion. How do we strike a balance between those two factors, all while utilizing crop waste for the future of renewable fuels production from biomass products?
Sure. That's a great question. And there is certainly no doubt that there's a diversity of these crop residues and their supply availability and all these kind of things. So the conditions you describe in Colorado may or may not work from a sustainable perspective, but I think what can be done in many places is, and in, certainly in some of the more dense agricultural producing states where there's a higher availability, we can take advantage of that. So I'd point you to, actually, a study that was done by Bloomberg New Energy Finance where they looked around the entire country and they said, look, if we just used 16% of the available, sustainably available crop residues, that could result in 16 billion gallons of fuel. Typical numbers you see in that space are around 25% of the residue removed, and that has obviously variety around the country depending on where you're looking. But from a sustainability perspective, if you go well under that number at just, say, 16% versus using all the crop residue or those kind of things, so well under the safe zone for sustainability purposes, it's still a very large and significant portion of fuel, 16 billion gallons in the United States alone.
And the next question is for Honorable James C. Greenwood. How close are we to being able to move away maybe from corn to other biomass products or cellulosic ethanol production in this country? Will it be done before the RFS mandate of 2022?
Well, I don't think so in its entirety. I think it's obviously the corn starch ethanol is huge volumes are involved in from that source. We are at an earlier stage in the development of these advanced biofuels, but I think that in certainly within our lifetimes, we'll see a transition increasingly moving towards non-food and feed sources of energy sources for ethanol, and I think the market will probably determine the rate at which that transition occurs.
And then my final two questions for Jim Embler, and hopefully I can get a chance to visit with Jim and do a regular interview sometime down the road. But you know, in Colorado in particular, we've got a lot of people in the livestock industry. This is cattle country on the Eastern Plains anyway. Can you speak to the livestock industry and explain exactly why the request for a temporary RFS waiver is unwarranted from the perspective facing this year's expansive drought and in the United States with the high feed costs that they are right now? Can you just kind of recite that for them one more time?
I'd rather have Jim Greenwood handle that. I would like to just add one thing to what he said, though, about the RFS and your question about how fast cellulosic is going to come on. And I would argue that, you know, you've heard of the proverbial hockey stick. There's a lot of concrete being put in the ground right now. There's people building plants, and I think you're going to see cellulosic take a little bit longer to get going than people thought, but once it gets going, much like the corn ethanol industry, once people prove that they could make money, plants got built very, very quickly. And I think you'll see the same on cellulosics, but I would turn the corn question over to the Honorable Greenwood.
Sure. So let me respond this way, and I think I mentioned this earlier. We're certainly not neither denying nor downplaying the seriousness of the drought that the country has experienced this summer, and nor are we downplaying the economic pain that has caused to those who are buying corn for their livestock and for their poultry. What we are saying is that if Congress or the administration or policymakers at the state level, for that matter, are moved, as they well should be, to try to respond to that problem, there are other ways to do that. there are existing programs and there are other programs and there are new programs that could be or new emergency responses that could be created to try to ease that economic burden. Our point is that turning on the RFS is neither likely to solve the problem, nor is it a fair and rational and balanced response. It basically says, as I mentioned earlier, it says we would put at risk our ability to have all of the environmental benefits, the national security benefits, the employment benefits that have been created by the RFS and are only going to grow from the RFS, put all of that at risk. And it is at risk when investors no longer feel that the RFS is a reliable and consistent standard for our country. It is not rational. And it is incredibly short-sighted to put all of that at risk because we've had a drought in 2012.
This is Admiral McGinn. I'd like to just add to what Carson Greenwood said. We go back to the title in 2007 of the Act, Energy Independence and Security Act. As painful, and it really is, as the drought is, there are a lot of threats out there that are existing that would interrupt our supply of imported oil and would cause very, very painful reverberations throughout the whole agricultural value chain. We've seen this too many times over the past 40 years, going back to the first Arab oil embargo in 1973. We need to continue the progress we're making to displace imported oil with renewable fuels. And the RFS is doing that in a way that no other piece of legislation has in that 40-year period. So we are really making progress. We just need to continue to do that and recognize that there are many threats out there. Certainly Mother Nature and drought is one of them. But we have to recognize we've got to make progress on becoming less dependent on imported oil.
And one final question for Honorable James Greenwood, if I may. What do you guys see as the end game for to reach a level where the RFS mandate doesn't have to go and you guys can stand on your own? When would that be?
I'm not sure that I have that crystal ball, but I think that in large measure, as I referenced earlier, once the federal government policy has created the environment in which the private sector has been able to see this technology demonstrated and succeed, I think then clearly we're going to see a rush to the hockey stick phenomena, if you will, a rush of private sector investment, and eventually the market will work its magic. But I can't tell you when that will be. I can tell you that we're out of time here, unless someone at Glover Park tells me otherwise. I think we're probably going to have to wrap it here. Thank you all for your participation. We're going to alert you again to our website, fuelsamerica.org, and to our Twitter feed, and certainly you can reach us throughout the course of this campaign for any additional questions and interviews that you'd like to engage us in. So thank you all for your participation, and enjoy the balance of your days.